This is the fourth day of this June 2012 six-day session. And we'll resume reading from the teachings of Yuan Wu in the form of letters. He was a Chinese Zen master of the 11th and 12th centuries. And this is from a book called Zen Letters, translated by the Cleary brothers. Here's a new letter. It begins, "The present perception is the truth, but the truth is beyond this perception. If you are attached to perception, then this is a perception. It is not the arriving at the truth." Let me just pause here. The present perception is the truth. So, we hear the chirp of a bird. Naturally, that's the truth. Or even to put it more simply, that is what it is. But what he's calling the truth is more than just the sound of the bird. And if we're attached to the sound of the bird, if we cling to it and think about it, wish it would be different, or wish it wouldn't go away, or then this is a perception. It is not the direct experience of things as they are. Same with the other sense perceptions, seeing, smelling, feeling, tasting, and thinking. In Buddhism, thinking, the faculty of thought, is the sixth, one additional sense to the other five. And it's not that thought either. Thought is no more outside the ultimate truth, ultimate reality. It's no more outside it than the sound of the bird. But if we are attached to the thought, then it becomes something else. He continues, "Those who arrive at truth transcend perception, but they manage to use perception without dwelling in perception. When you pass directly through perception and get free of it, it is all the fundamental truth." This paragraph brought to mind a passage from the Mumonkan, collection of koans, and this is from the 16th case in the book, and the commentary, Mumon's commentary to the case. The case is named The Sound of the Bell, and here's Mumon's commentary. "In practicing Zen, you should avoid being swayed by sounds and forms. Even though you may attain insight by hearing a sound or seeing a form, this is simply the ordinary way of things. Nor is it anything to talk about when a Zen person is able to master sounds and control forms and thus clearly see the reality of everything and be wonderfully free in everything he does. But though this is so, just tell me, does the sound come to the ear, or does the ear go to the sound? Even if you are able to transcend both sound and silence, how do you speak of that fact? If you listen with your ear, it is hard to hear truly. If you hear with your eye, then you are intimate at last." Right on cue. So what about that? Does the sound come to the ear, or does the ear go to the sound? And then back to Yuan Wu's letter. This truth is not being or non-being. It is not speech or silence. Yet it can manifest both being and non-being, both speech and silence. It is forever constant and unchanging. One way to understand what he's alluding to is awareness. Let's plug in the word awareness for truth. Truth is such an abstract word. Translators, they can't win if a translated book comes off really well, then the author gets the credit. If it doesn't seem right, then the translator gets the blame. This is what's so nice about the word the way, which is in itself a translation of the Chinese Tao, T-A-O, Tao. So the translator could have said, the way is not being or non-being. It is not speech or silence and so forth. And for that way, we can substitute awareness. Awareness is not being or non-being. It's not speech or silence. Yet it can manifest both being and non-being, both speech and silence. This awareness is forever constant and unchanging. Therefore, Yunmen said, he's quoting the great master Yunmen or Ummon, it cannot be existent when you speak of it and non-existent when you don't, or existent when you think of it and non-existent when you don't. Let's just appreciate that for a minute. If this follows Yuan Wu saying, it is forever constant and unchanging. So this awareness cannot be existent just when you speak of it, and non-existent when you don't, or it can't be existent just when you think of it, and non-existent when you don't. It's constant and unchanging. Awareness. Mind. You must subtly arrive at this way and get its great function. Always let transcendent wisdom appear, whether you are speaking or silent, whatever you are doing. Why would you say that it is close at hand when you are in your teacher's presence, but far away when you are in the countryside? Or we could also pose the question, why would you say that it's close at hand when you're in Sesshin, but far away when you're not in Sesshin? There's no more of this truth in Sesshin than outside Sesshin. It's just more accessible to us, for most of us, because of all the sitting we're doing. We were more aware of our awareness. And he says, as you go directly forward, naturally you will encounter it wherever you are. all the enlightened ones and ancestral teachers take this one true thing very seriously. It is spread among beings of all potentials, high and low, noble and lowly, without any preferences or aversions. It is in all the myriad kinds of action, naturally real, clear, and complete. If you make a special thing out of your views of Buddha Dharma and mystic marvels, then there is a lack. But if you are able to refrain from creating arbitrary views and are clean and naked like this, then it is completely revealed. This is the whole point of sitting, is to reveal what is our nature, to strip the mind of its accretions, of its conditioning, even if just sporadically, just short periods, to do that in order to get a sense of this bright sun that is mind, true mind. If this matter were in words, then it should be definable in a single sentence, with no further change. Why would there be thousands and thousands of sayings imparted by enlightened adepts, with no end to them? From this we know that it is not within words, but we need to use words to illustrate this matter. Sharp-spirited people should directly comprehend this idea. So, if there were an answer to a koan, just a simple answer, a koan, especially a breakthrough koan, like mu, what is this? Then I would be happy just to give it to the student. But it's this kind of an answer, if it's not the student's own experience, then it's just words. It's just a collection of letters and spaces. It has to be the experience of each person. For example, I could say that to the question, what is mu? Well, it's everything. And at the same time, it's nothing. There. What does that do for you? It's true. Those who realize transcendence pass through words and phrases and can make them come to life. They can use one saying as 100,000 sayings, or use 100,000 sayings as one saying. Again, as we said earlier in Sesshin, it's not the words. It's the understanding behind the words, and therefore the spirit of understanding that comes through in the words. But the words, just the words themselves, are just abstractions. Next letter. When Bodhidharma came from the West, bringing the Zen transmission to China, he didn't set up written or spoken formulations. He only pointed directly to the human mind. Bodhidharma, of course, is considered the founder of Zen and was famous for his 9 years of wall gazing, sitting in a cave, meditating, pointing directly to the human mind. If we speak of direct pointing, this just refers to what is inherent in everyone. The whole essence appears responsively from within the shell of ignorance. This is no different in ordinary people than in all the sages since time immemorial. It is what we call the natural, real, inherent nature, fundamentally pure, luminous, and sublime. Again, mind. Original mind, original nature, essential nature, true nature, Buddha mind. What is it? What is Mu? What is this? Now, here, this. It swallows up and spits out all of space. It is a single solid realm that stands out alone, free of the senses and their objects. I think of a famous Zen phrase, one slab of iron stretching 10,000 miles. Just detach from thoughts and cut off sentiments and transcend the ordinary conventions. Use your own inherent power and take up its great capacity and great wisdom right where you are. It is like letting go when you're hanging from a mile-high cliff, releasing your body and not relying on anything anymore. This is a favorite image in Zen. In one of the koans, Mumon says, just let go your hold on the cliff. What's the cliff? Basically, thoughts. The difference between thoughts and the true thing itself, the direct experience, is incalculable. It's unfathomable. It's the difference between reading a menu and actually eating the food. Totally shed the obstructions of views and understanding so that you are like a person who has died the great death. Your breath is cut off and you arrive at great cessation and great rest on the fundamental ground. Your sense faculties have no inkling of this, and your consciousness and perceptions and sentiments and thoughts do not reach this far. What does he mean? What could be beyond consciousness itself and perceptions and sentiments, feelings, thoughts? How can none of this reach this true mind that he's referring to? When he says your breath is cut off, of course, this is speaking figuratively, dying the great death. Dying to this prison of ego consciousness. This reference of his to views totally shed the obstructions of views We have in Buddhism, we have the phrase right view. It's one of the elements of the Noble Eightfold Path. Sometimes it's called right views or right understanding. And it's a great part of Buddhist teaching. But in Zen, we take a different perspective, which is to clear the mind of all views, so-called right views or wrong views. Empty the mind so that it is restored to its utter purity. Just skipping a couple paragraphs here, he says, at this stage you are free to go forward in the wild field without choosing, picking up whatever comes to hand. The meaning of the ancestral teachers is clear in all that grows there. What's more, the thickets of green bamboo and the masses of yellow flowers and the fences and walls and tiles and pebbles are inanimate things teaching the Dharma. The water birds and the groves of trees expound the truths of suffering, emptiness, and selflessness. Based on the one true reality, they extend objectless compassion, and from the great jewel light of nirvana, they reveal uncontrived, surpassingly wondrous powers. The water birds and the groves of trees. I could say the rain, the moon, the chirping of crickets expound the truths of suffering, emptiness, and selflessness. These three are what are known as the three marks of existence, the three characteristics of existence. These three are a very basic, rudimentary, important part of Buddhist doctrine that everyone here should know by now. Three characteristics of existence: suffering, or dukkha. That's also the first of the four noble truths. The second mark of existence is emptiness, that all things are fundamentally without enduring permanent substance to them. And the third follows from the second. Third is selflessness. If there is no permanent substance to anything, then there certainly can't be a self, a permanent self. How are the herons and the cardinals expounding these truths? Listen. These teachings don't have to come from outside. A sigh, a cough. A cry. All are expounding these three characteristics of existence. A monk asked Zhao Zhou, "What is the teaching in the distant mountains when no one is present?" Zhao Zhou said, "Large rocks are large, small rocks are small." Another letter. "Ever since antiquity, with excellence beyond measure, the sages have experienced this great cause alone, as if planting great potential and capacity. By the power of their vows of compassion, they have brought forth direct indications of the one thing that is most profound and most recondite, the common essence of all the myriad forms of being. Without setting up stages, they abruptly transcend to realize this essence alone. Since before the time when nothing existed, this essence has been ever still and unmoved, determining the basis of all conscious beings. It permeates all times and is beyond all thought. It is beyond holy and ordinary, and transcends all knowledge and views. It has never fluctuated or wavered. It is there, pure and naked and full of life. All beings, both animate and inanimate, have it complete within them." That is why when Shakyamuni Buddha was first born, he immediately pointed to the heavens and to the earth and with a great lion's roar brought it right out in front. That's the legend, is he took seven steps and with one hand held up and the other down, he said, "Above the heavens and below the heavens, I alone, the world honored one. Everything is Buddha. Everything is endowed with this luminous Buddha nature. There is nothing but Buddha nature." How can that be? When we, everywhere we look, we see suffering, cruelty, conflict, pettiness, greed, hostility. Still, there is only this enlightened nature. And I'm not talking about enlightened as differentiated from unenlightened. There is just this essential nature. Then, after he had left home and sought enlightenment for 6 years, he awakened at the sight of the morning star. In the end, on Vulture Peak, he initiated the Zen transmission by holding up a flower. All that was important is that we should possess the comprehension of this true eye. He goes on, "In general, when superior wisdom, excellent capacity, and natural potential are already there, it is just a matter of working to penetrate through surely and truly. When you put it to use, you command great potential and unfurl great function, moving even before any impulse to action, operating free of things. And he quotes one of his predecessors, Yantao, Japanese Ganto. Spurning things is superior, following things is inferior. If we talk about battle, each one's strength is in the turning point. What does this mean? Spurning things is superior, is not clinging to things. Following things is inferior. This is what we are practicing every minute, that we're certainly when we're sitting, and as much as we can when we're moving about in our daily lives. It's a way of staying present. It is the only reality, is this present moment. Everything else is thoughts. It's just this. Everything else gets in the way. This direct perception of things as they are. And so the great Japanese Zen master Basui put it very simply. Cut, 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 cut. He goes on, if you can turn fast on top of things, then everything will submit to you, and everything will be in your grasp. Capturing and releasing, rolling up and rolling out, all can be transformed. At all times, you remain peaceful and tranquil without having anything whatsoever hanging in your mind. In action, you accord with the situation and its potential, holding the means of discernment within yourself. Shifting and changing and successfully adapting, you attain great freedom. All things and all circumstances open up before your blade, like bamboo splitting, all bending down with the wind. He's pointing here to a state of great freedom that only comes through enlightenment. Magnificent, fluid freedom, responsiveness, adaptability. This is so rare. 99% of humanity has these obscurations of thoughts, self-concerns, things hanging in the mind. Compare this kind of free responsiveness to the state that T.S. Eliot describes in one of his famous poems. He says, between the idea and the reality, between motion and the act, falls the shadow. Between conception and creation, between emotion and response, falls the shadow. Who would not want to get out from under this shadow? These clouds of confusion, delusion. Therefore, if where you stand is reality, then your actions have power. If where you stand is reality, is in the present. Needless to say, leading brave heroes, commanding fierce warriors, routing powerful bandits, comforting the farmers, pacifying the nation, and assisting the work of restoring social harmony and cultural florescence all depend on this one revelation. Many of these Zen masters, both in China and Japan, lived at a time of tremendous civil war, brutality. So we find these references strewn in through the texts. Turning the topmost key, achieving something that cannot be taken away in 10,000 generations, you see and hear the same as the ancient Buddhas and share the same knowledge and functioning. And then he quotes one of his predecessors, Deshan, also known by his Japanese name, Toksan. A Buddha is just someone with no concerns. The translation, I think it's more... more helpful, more illuminating that I've read elsewhere is, these are his words, if you have no concern in your mind and no mind in your concerns, then naturally your mind will be empty yet luminous, calm yet sublime. If you have no concern in your mind, certainly no self-concern, and no mind in your concerns. Well, naturally, to go through daily life, we have concerns at times. But it's how we respond to those concerns, what we do with them, whether we just chew on them and fret and fall into imaginations about what can happen or are paralyzed by indecision, that's one thing. But he say, if you have no mind in your concerns, when you're concerned, just be concerned. And then act out of it. Do something about it, or do nothing about it, but don't get caught. Don't dwell in worries. Because you're just dwelling in thoughts. You're just fleeing the present. And then he quotes another master, Yongji. It is not apart from here, always profoundly clear and still. If you search for it, you know you cannot see it. We chant in the harmony. What's it called? Harmony of relative and absolute. Within darkness there is light, but do not try to find that light. Why not? Why not try to find that light? Because the very act of seeking means that we are separated from it. seeking by its nature thrusts us in a state of darkness. Now, when I'm talking about seeking or searching, this is different from questioning or wondering. Seeking in this example, seeking implies having a goal in mind, some imaginary place that's other than here and now. And so long as we're grasping for that goal, then we're lost. Wondering what is mu, what is this, is something different. There's no goal there. We're not trying to get to some place, some future remote place called awakening or whatever. Those who are determined to practice the way, practice self-awareness and self-understanding 24 hours a day. They think of this and focus on this. They know that the one great cause is there right where they stand, that it is in sages without being augmented and in ordinary people without being diminished. They know that it stands alone, free of senses and sense objects, and that it far transcends material things. True practitioners don't set up fixed locations in anything they do. They are clear and tranquil with solid concentration, and the myriad changes and transformations never disturb them. They appear in response to conditions and go into action as they encounter events, leaving nothing incomplete. The myriad changes and transformations never disturb them. This is certainly an exalted state of development, because what seems to throw us as human beings more than anything is change. We want to arrange things according to our likes and our preferences, and even if we can do that to some degree, then things change. We see it right in our meditation. We may have periods of tranquility, clarity. Okay, now, just stay like that. But does it stay like that? No. We need to transcend conditions. All right, our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.